Hello and welcome to the October 2025 edition of Roundabout, the Dawlish and Tynmouth area talking newspaper's monthly magazine. I'm Camilla Taylor. It is a happy 10th anniversary to us. Just over 10 years ago, our talking newspaper was set up by Valerie Forrester, and the first Roundabout programme was recorded on the 30th of September 2015. Valerie Forrester, John Townsend, and I are still around from the beginning. Since then, we have been joined by Stephen Taylor, Mary MacDonald, Mike Smith from the Green Team, Fran Frank and Norma Orty from the Blue Team, Sue Smallwood from the Yellow Team, David Quay from the Red Team, David Picton, Jeannie Lloyd-Jacob, who shares her visually impaired perspective to the programme, and Jenny Horton. We have lost some dear friends from the Roundabout team over the years. Jonathan Webster, who teamed up with Valerie and set up the studio, sadly passed away in July 2018. With his background in broadcasting, he was responsible for voice auditioning, setting up of the teams for Here and Now, and training our first team of producers. It was his idea to set up Roundabout, which would offer some original content to the listener, so we are hugely indebted to him. His wife, Aileen Webster, known for her Letter from a Dog Walker segment, sadly passed away in January last year. Jenny Jenkins and Babs Astley had to give up contributing to Roundabout due to family commitments and ill health. We remember them all with deep fondness and gratitude. Let us find out what we have in store for you this month. Last month, John Townsend was in conversation with Tony Liddington. We have part two of their conversation. This will be followed by Tony Liddington's choice of music. Fran Frank has put together another set of 10 quiz questions for you. The answers will appear towards the end of the programme. David Picton will share his poem entitled It's Been a Long Life. Norma Orty will be reading her story entitled Arthur. Mary MacDonald and Stephen Taylor will be discussing the book The Trouble with Goats and Sheep by Joanna Cannon. This will be followed by an article read by Valerie Forrester about a very unusual snail. We will then have a poem from Jenny Horton entitled Best Before. There will be a recipe from blind baker Penny Melville Brown. Fran Frank will be back with the answers to the quiz questions. David Quay will be sharing his experiences of another mode of transport and has chosen an appropriate piece of music to follow on from that. Last month, we had part one of John Townsend's conversation with Tony Liddington. Here is part two of their conversation.
Hello, this is John Townsend back again, talking to Dr. Tony Liddington, or also Uncle Taco. Let's talk about the Uncle Taco for a moment. What's all that about?
Well, when I first formed my Pierrot troupe, when I was just 21, 22, we wanted to have an anonymity. We were all signing on and wanted to avoid getting arrested. So we had to have some sort of alter ego.
Yeah.
So we took the first letter of our first name and added Acco to it so that we sounded like an Italian acrobat troupe.
Oh.
So I became Taco, and there was Sacco and Paco and Acco and Daco. An uncle, because in the days of minstrels and Pierrot troops, the leader of the troop was always known as uncle.
I see.
A kind of an avuncular character
who
was in charge nominally, a little bit like in Dad's Army. You have somebody trying to be in charge, but not really, with Mr. Mannering. So that role of Uncle Taco, so that's where the name comes from.
I see. And the Acco, are you an acrobat?
Not in the slightest.
No. But I think you've been known to whiz around on stilts, haven't you?
I don't do stilts. No, I've done lots of running around. Other people I work with who work on stilts and unicycles and a range of other circus skills.
Yeah.
But my skills have always been in clowning rather than particular physical skills.
Yes.
I mean, I was a keen brilliant rugby player, but I didn't ever use that in performance.
No. What about juggling? Is that something that you...
I bring other people in to do juggling. Yeah, it's not something that I've ever been particularly interested in. No. I could bowl a cricket ball.
Yeah. And fire eating is really not part of your repertoire. No. But let's talk about some of the seaside stuff. And so there you were as a student in Sussex. You, I think you said last time we were talking, you went to Edinburgh Fringe to do... you've done several shows there? Or
yes.
And that was... What sort of shows were you doing there?
Some of them were devised pieces and sort of comedy sketch shows. Yeah. Some of them were... I did an adaptation of Dr. Faustus.
Oh.
Where it was an immersive performance where we filled the place with frankincense. Everybody sat 6 foot apart from each other and everybody was dressed in monk's habits. And I wrote a one-person opera called The Life and Times of Hieronymus Bosch. Yeah. So it was, in one sense, these days I'd probably say it was quite pretentious what I was trying to do, but actually it was a really good place to try out.
It's a good training ground.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I guess a lot of your technique is to involve the audience as much as possible, and lots of interactive stuff. So, yeah, let's talk about seaside. I mean, obviously, seaside entertainment has changed so much over the years, and this is what interests you and what you've researched a good deal. Are you sort of trying to bring back some of this?
Yes, or at least to say that it has never really gone away. I'm kind of proudest when people come up and say that they didn't realise that work like this still existed and were amazed that it is still funny. And I say, well, you only need to watch an audience looking at a Punch and Judy show and the children are rapt and the parents are rapt and the grandparents are rapt as well. They're all totally engaged in this little booth with characters waggling and bashing one another. And the people who are on their screens aren't the kids. It's the grandparents and parents. Yeah. They're the ones who are providing the kind of worst role models you could imagine. The children, the youngsters who are on the blankets or on the mats at the front, their full attention is given to it and they participate fully. So I'm always pleased when people say what we produce is timeless. Mm. I'm not trying to be a historic, nostalgic entertainment. I'm trying to do something now in the moment where people forget the place that they're in, the difficulties of the world that they're in. Mm. Most of our entertainment is free. Yeah. So it's free at the point of delivery. So it's like the National Health Service, but we're a national entertainment service. So people encounter us on a seafront and they can just sit down. And so a single mum who's got 3-4 kids with them and can't afford the ice cream, but they can sit down for an hour and enjoy our stuff or 2 hours or longer. Mm. And they do. And they come back week after week and they come and see us perform. And of course, that relies on funding. So that relies on local authorities who are quite strapped these days. But if we don't get that funding, we can't afford to be there. And so, you know, we're not in Tynmouth and we're not in Dawlish this year because there is no money, apparently, to be able to fund this. And yet I think without that support, you won't have free entertainment. And that means that there isn't anything for people to come to enjoy as two or three generations. They've got the sea, they've got the sand, they've got the ice cream. Where are they going to sit and enjoy that ice cream and their sandwiches?
Yeah, very good. So you've obviously done plenty of Punch and Judy yourself over the years. And I think now your son does a tremendous show. How did you learn that? Because it's such a huge amount, isn't it, to do in just you in a booth doing all the everything.
Yes, but then all performance is about playing different emotions, and different emotions are like different characters. Yes, they have different voices, and there is a dexterity and a kind of precision about what needs to be where. But pantomime's the same. You know, a fast change in a pantomime is like a fast change with a puppet.
Yeah,
and you always have to be aware of what the audience is aware of. So as a performer, one of my skills, I would say, is understanding what an audience is perceiving and what the story is that they understand. So there may not be a puppet up on in view, but the conversation might still be taking place. Or the conversation might be between a puppet that's up and nothing that's there, but you're answering from beneath. You're asking the audience to participate in it as well. So as a director of theatre, I think it's a similar skill. It's understanding what the audience is understanding from the show that's being performed. And that's different from simply being an actor that's sort of regurgitating lines or playing their own vision of what the character dynamic is supposed to be at any one point. I think the most important thing for any performer is to understand what the audience is gathering from what is being shown on stage.
Mm. I mean, probably you don't know how many Punch and Judy operators there are now in the country. But
about 280.
Are there? And, oh, bet you know them all. And do they use any projection for the voices? I mean, in an outdoor space to be heard?
Most Punch and Judy guys use some form of microphone.
Okay.
Because they're competing with ice creams and
I wonder if that's
a band on a stage.
And I have to, this is probably a trade secret, but you know, the voice of Mr. Punch, can you give us some idea of how that's done?
If anyone has ever blown a grass between their thumbs got that reedy sound, that is the basis of what some people call the squeaker, but in the trade we call the swazzle.
Yeah.
And that's a bit like that grass reed. There's a reed that's inside the mouth that creates the squawk of Mr. Punch, which in many ways is just like your listeners might remember the things like the Wooden Tops or the Clangers, or more recently things like the Teletubbies.
Yeah.
Inarticulate voices, pre-speech.
Yeah.
And that's what Mr. Punch is. He's a kind of atavistic monster. He's like a 2 or 3 year old. He's like a Donald Trump of the puppet world.
Okay. Well put. But this swazzle you keep in your mouth all the time, and you do the other voices with that in, and then you have to blow or whatever you do through the reed.
That's right.
So that must take a bit of work.
Practice, skill, and lots of mistakes. Everything, like riding a bicycle. Yeah. You have to fall off, you have to scrape your knees.
Yeah, I bet you got many stories about things that go wrong.
that's another 10-minute section, isn't it?
But I know, one area of your work that I'm fascinated in, and you've managed to get some funding over the years for this, is oral histories, whereby you interview people, presumably older people, about previous times, and then use that as well. You tell me.
Well, since I've been in Dawlish, I've done two oral history projects. I did one called Silver Screens, where I interviewed people from different care homes and also the lunchtime club about going to the cinema in the 1930s to the 50s. And then we made a CD out of that, of their memories, together with a kind of narration that went along with it and lots of sound effects, which we then gave to all the participants. And we also sent it to the archives and went to the museum and went to the libraries and to all the local schools. And then earlier this year, I got some money from the Teignbridge Arts Projects Fund to do a project called At the Hop, which was looking at going dancing in the 1950s.
Yeah.
And we interviewed people in Tynmouth at the Alice Cross, various of the care homes, and also here in the Strand Centre, where we're doing this recording. Got their memories, and then we launched it after we'd made the recording, the half-hour recording. We launched it at a dance event with live music and a DJ spinning platters from the age. People came who were swing dancers. The old folk came who'd given their memories. Some of their families came. Some youngsters came. We had free tea and cakes. Everybody dressed up.
Brilliant.
It was a grand time. And the whole of that recording was done by some of my young trainees. So one of the things I'm trying to do as I get older is increasingly to hand responsibility on to the next generation.
Brilliant. So how do you recruit your trainees? Where do they come from?
Well, when I get the money, which that depends on funding from the Arts Council or from wherever I can find it, Heritage Lottery or something, I then put out to local people, so it tends to be youngsters between about 17 and 25, who are interested in the kind of work that we do, who apply to be part of it. And they need to live in South Devon, they need to be independent, they need to be able to get to where we're rehearsing, which might be Exeter, might be Dawlish. And then I can take, usually I try and take between 4 and 6 in any one year. I didn't get any funding this year, so there's no training program this year, but I'm employing all my previous trainees as professionals now, because they've learned the skills and they can now do the work that I need them to do. So if people believe in it, hopefully they will support us doing that sort of work. And there's nothing more wonderful than having me as an old stager there on stage with these young people who I've trained, and performing for kids who might be 3 years of age, their parents and their grandparents in their own hometowns.
No, tremendous. If people are interested in, for example, the Hop, is that archive in the museum now, or where could they?
I think, it is in the museum. It's also on our website, I think, as well.
Okay.
We have a YouTube channel, if people are familiar with that.
All right, that's interesting.
So Promenade Promotions, or Prom, if you put that in and have a dig around, you'll find quite a lot of information about it. If you can't, then just get in touch with me and you'll find my email there on our website. And okay. I'll always reply.
Right, lovely. Now, we have a summer season, well, probably starting, cranking up as we speak.
Absolutely.
So will you be travelling far and wide to do all sorts?
Yes, although in my dotage, increasingly, it's more local. So yeah. This weekend, we'll be in Exmouth over in Crediton. Spike's going to be doing his Punch and Judy at 4th Street Flea Market in Exeter. Oh. We're at the Quayside every Friday. We're at Dawlish Warren every Thursday. Spike's at Dawlish Warren at the pub at the Bridge Inn every Monday. And Tuesday, he's got a hotel in Paignton now as well.
Ah, and we're going right through, through the summer holidays, as in when the school holidays are on. Do you go into September?
Yes, I mean, the season traditionally ends really at the end of September actually around half term.
Yeah.
But after the schools have gone back, of course, it's just weekends. At the moment, it's weekends mainly. We do get occasional other gigs, but generally, it's the whole of August. We perform 5-6 times a week, which is what I've done all my life. And then it's weekends the rest of the time. And I fit all that around my university work, where I'm teaching this stuff to the academics.
There's quite a lot of metaphorical juggling going on, really.
Absolutely. And fire juggling and recycling, you name it.
Yeah. And probably quite exhausting. I mean, if you're on the road a lot and doing all these things.
Yeah, I'll start at 7-8 in the morning, load the van, drive 2 hours, up to 2 hours, do the gig for 6 hours non-stop, so we don't stop all day, pack the van, drive back. So I'll do 14-hour days, and I'll do that 5 days a week.
Yeah, but you obviously love it.
Of course.
And your enthusiasm comes over beautifully. Well, so obviously after September, at the end of the season, you just put your feet up and that's it.
If only that were the case, I'll be already mailing out for next season.
So pipe and slippers, not yet.
No.
Well, as with all my guests, I invite you to finish with a piece of music of your choice. I guess there's a whole range of things that might be appropriate in your case, but what would you like?
Well, how about going right back to the start for my inspiration?
Oh, yes.
And going back to Ralph Reeder and his gang shows. And we're riding along on the crest of a wave.
Oh, yeah.
I hope everyone will sing along.
I'm sure. Well, we can anyway, yes. Well, it just remains for me then to say thank you, Tony, for telling us about just some of your background in a specialised form of performing arts, and best wishes for this summer season and beyond. Thanks for chatting to me, and, well, it's goodbye for now as we go over to Riding Along on the Crest of a Wave.
That song was Riding Along on the Crest of a Wave by Ralph Reeder. If you were in the Scouts or Girl Guides, then perhaps this song brought back some memories. It's now over to Fran Frank.
Hello again. Time for this month's general knowledge quiz. As usual, there will be 10 questions together with 3 possible answers for you to consider. The correct answers will be revealed towards the end of the programme. So let's get started. Question 1. Which Shakespeare comedy features the characters Oberon, Titania, Puck and Bottom? Was it A. A Winter's Tale, B. A Midsummer Night's Dream, or C. Much Ado About Nothing? Question 2. What is the offspring of a male donkey and a female horse called? Is it A. Hinny, B. Ass, or C. Mule? Question 3. What does DC stand for in the place name Washington, DC? Is it A. Driver Conurbation, B. Downtown City, or C. District of Columbia? Question 4. What is author J.K. Rowling's first name? Is it A. Jennifer, B. Julia, or C. Joanne? Question 5. Where in England is the National Waterways Museum? Is it A. London, B. Bristol, or C. Gloucester? Question 6. In ITV's Spitting Image puppet show, which former Prime Minister was depicted with grey skin and clothes? Was it A. Gordon Brown, B. John Major, or C. Tony Blair? Question 7. In which West Country city were cricketing legend W.G. Grace and film star Cary Grant born? Was it A. Bristol, B. Truro, or C. Exeter? Question 8. Purple Emperor, Monarch, and Queen of Spain are all types of what? Are they A. Birds, B. Butterflies, or C. Flowers? Question 9. Epsom Racecourse is in which English county? Is it A. Surrey, B. Sussex, or C. Hampshire? Question 10. On which Mediterranean island is the holiday resort of Magaluf? Is it A. Malta, B. Mallorca, or C. Ibiza? Well, there you are. 10 assorted questions with various options to think about. I'll come back in a little while to run through the questions again and provide the correct answers. Enjoy the rest of the programme.
Here is David Picton with his poem for this month.
This poem features a lady called Charlotte, who lives in a care home. One day she receives a very special visitor, and the poem itself includes dialogue between Charlotte and her visitor. And the poem's title is It's Been a Long Life. Settling at the window seat, the visitor smiled a kindly smile. No one else in the day room seemed to notice. Charlotte noticed. How could she not? The visitor spoiled her view. The window framed her world. Looking out was her joy these days, as the garden spoke the seasons. "Tell me, Charlotte," asked the visitor, "about when you were young." A tear glistened and traced Charlotte's cheek. She told of childhood days, ascending the heavens, dancing with ballerina clouds, and on moonstruck nights, lying on hillsides barefoot. "The stars twinkled my toes. I played with clowns. Clocks forgot to tell the time, and days stretched beyond forever. But they came to an end." "The days are still there. They're always there," said the visitor. "We just forget how to play." "I lost myself in diaries," Charlotte continued. "Schedules full of responsibilities. The days were no longer mine to own." "And what of those days?" asked the visitor. Charlotte told and revelled in the telling of how hers had been a long life, how she had raised her glass and tasted fine wine, if not champagne. A good life, an ordinary life, a family to love. "I remember my children's joy, farmyards and zoos, Play-Doh and paints, fairground rides, and shining faces that lift my heart." Charlotte spoke of the chalice raised and the challenge she accepted. She recalled sunshine and rain, a life of sweet and sour, silk and burlap, burdens shouldered. "I should like to leave just a little of myself behind, to know I mattered." But Charlotte feared her life inconsequential, fading as a shadow fades at dusk, her memories becoming dust, to be scattered by the wind, her footprints being no more than sand washed away at next tide. "Charlotte, you have lived a life fulfilled. You have done all that needed to be done. As a pebble dropped, you have sent ripples that have touched so many others in ways you have never known or could ever know this side of the veil. You have sown seeds, and they have flourished. Your gentle words as summer rains have watered parched lands. You have scattered clouds. You have dried tears and turned faces to the sun. You have loved and been loved. You have shared happiness. You have mattered in the hearts of others. You will be remembered." Charlotte smiled, her eyes closed, her breath stilled, and the clock stopped. The visitor took Charlotte by the hand. "Come now, Charlotte, my dear Charlotte. It's time for us, once again, to dance with the clouds, lie barefoot on hillsides, let the stars twinkle our toes, and play with the clowns. Together, we'll let the days stretch beyond forever."
We now have a story from Norma Orty.
Arthur. Early morning mist covered the ground. It was still dark, and workers on their way to their daily toil were shadows as they passed the inadequate gas lights. Arthur knew the area well. He was a master builder and had built many of the fine houses that face the common. He had earned a reputation as a reliable and honest builder and had a good team of workers. Presently they were hurrying to complete a corner villa facing Tooting Beck. A few weeks and it would be ready for the buyer, who was a local doctor. Arthur was a bachelor. He lived in lodgings in a street just off the Broadway, where his landlady cared for him like a son. He caught the horse-drawn tram to go to the site and was pleased to note that the fog had lifted. Bill the decorator was busy preparing to paint the staircase. "Morning, Governor," he called. "Looks as if it'll be a good day." Arthur agreed and told Bill that he was going to the Midland Bank to collect the wages. "Do you have everything you need?" "Just another couple of rolls of wallpaper, please." Arthur decided to walk to the bank. As he progressed along the road past the well-presented houses, several doors opened and the gentleman owners stepped out in time to board the horse-drawn truck omnibus, which would take them into the city. Their maids handed them their briefcase and bowler hat, and they waved to their family before joining the other fellows. At the bank, Arthur was hailed by the bank manager, Mr. Brown, who was most distressed. "It would appear that we have been robbed," he confided to Arthur. "We're missing a number of gold sovereigns." "I heard you," said a nearby customer. "Maybe I can help." He was a smart gent, dressed in tweedy cap and a deerstalker hat. The under-manager replied, "Oh, Mr. Holmes, we would be most grateful for help, especially from you." His tone was most deferential. "He's a detective," he whispered to Arthur. Mr. Brown showed Holmes into his inner sanctum. The coins were in a flat box and waited collection by a lady. They were in this drawer. "Who came in here this morning?" asked Holmes, after closely scrutinizing the room. "Only one person, a cleaning woman. She's worked here for 15 years and is admirable." "But she wasn't alone," said Holmes. He had walked behind the big desk and picked up a small wooden box which held a set of draft pieces. It had been left in the knee-hole space. "Call her in," he requested. It appeared that she had left at 8 when Mr. Brown arrived. "And who was the child with her?" inquired Mr. Holmes. Brown's looked shocked. "How did you know?" "She brought her grandson. He's just 4. And his mother is in hospital." "Elementary, dear Brown." The child explored the drawers while his minder was busy and played draughts with the sovereigns. "Incidentally, sir, you were most careless. They should have been locked away." "He took yours and left his. You must hasten to find her." "She goes to work in the hotel next door after finishing here," gasped Mr. Brown. "I'm on my way." Lawrence attended to Mr. Holmes and Mr. Arthur immediately. "Thank you, sir." Arthur collected his wages envelope and, bidding goodbye to all, hurried back to the site. He knew that the beautiful Polish immigrant girl, Rose, would be waiting, calling to collect her father's wages. Arthur was becoming very fond of her.
Mary MacDonald and Stephen Taylor are here with this month's book review.
Hello, listener. This month, Stephen and I have been looking at The Trouble with Goats and Sheep by Joanna Cannon. An odd little tale about growing up, about secrecy, tiny communities, all the things that we know go on that are never revealed. It's quite sweet, actually. I was a bit nervous about the start. It's nicely written. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, so this is very English, I think it's fair to say.
Extremely.
We do have a kind of Indian family who move in halfway through, but they're pretty minor characters. It's essentially a
Well, it's to
very,
bring out the oddness of the people,
yes,
again, isn't it,
very
for a distant town.
English little community. It's in the East Midlands. It never quite says exactly where it is. And it's 1976, so it's the hot, hot summer. And everybody's in shorts and bikinis and getting a bit bonkers, really, I think.
I remember it well.
And the central character is a 10-year-old girl called Grace. Now, I was 10 in 1976, so for me, this was very familiar. All the cultural references, the sitcoms, Angel Delight for their pudding, Brian Clough. It's full of that kind of 1970s Englishness.
And that's what brings it home to you, I think. It's all the familiarity, things we know, things some of us remember directly, some of things which our parents would know. It is the small villagey type sense of it. It's, we think it's in a city because they're going about in odd ways and travelling. But the a point in this as well, which was imperative at the time, is the local bus. And this poor old bus really takes a star turn in this little story. I thought it was very nicely written. I was a little bit confused, bobbing backwards and forwards to who lived where. And the fact that some people were referred to by their Christian names, and I was looking at them as their surnames. But all in all, it was very of its time, very clearly of its time, as you say, with the various references. And the little girls, 10 years old, not like 10-year-olds now, really with that innocence, hearing some words in church which affected them, something, a little phrase that we do come across from time to time, sorting the sheep from the goats. And that's where it all goes horribly wrong.
Yes, it's all in a little, it's called the Avenue. It's like a little close in an estate, sort of little community we all grew up in, everybody knows, everyone's very familiar with. And then one of the residents, a lady called Margaret Creasy, goes missing. She just disappears without her shoes. Which is, and the little girls are trying to investigate why this has happened, because it's during the summer holidays. And the question, of course, is she alive? Is she dead? Why is she gone? And then gradually all the little secrets of all the residents of this street come out. And that's really the basis of the story.
It is. And yet, all those secrets coming out, not everybody knows every secret. A lot of it's made up, assumed, presumed. The only person who knows the secrets isn't there.
We also, I think, need to explain the title. So the book is called The Trouble with Goats and Sheep, which doesn't really give you an idea about what it is at all. It's not really about goats or sheep. It's about the idea that in any community, there are goats who are people who kind of stand out from the crowd, who are sort of on the edge, not really trusted by everybody else. And in this, there's a particular character who's very much shunned by the rest of the community, very unfairly, as it turns out. And the girls see him as a goat and everyone else as sheep. But I think, well, there's a sort of message in there, isn't there, really, that we're all goats to an
extent.
Yes,
and that's because they picked it up in church, and being little girls, took it almost literally. Good people are sheep, bad people are goats. And that's where their search started. It was really quite a fun book in the end, and a nice surprise ending, and a happy ending in a way.
Yeah, yeah. When I was reading, I thought this is cozy crime. There's not really any crime. It was sort of imagined that there may be. Well, there's a bit, but it's all very, and it's quirky.
Yes.
You know, this sort of face of Jesus appearing, sort of a splash of creosote by a drainpipe on a garage.
Just at the right moment, though. Just at the right moment.
One thing I didn't like so much is I think she's a little bit snobbish about these people. They're all very stupid. They're all very credulous. They're not very nice. And I think it would have been nicer to have, you know, perhaps a little bit of decency in there. They're all just
especially,
a bit
yes.
suspicious and unpleasant to each other.
I think so, and I think you're right. But also, with such a small group of houses, they were terribly widely mixed. I would have thought a posh little close like that would have been a posh little close, not with such extremes. But then extremes make for interest.
Okay, well, next month we're going to be doing a very different kind of book. This is called The Shadow of the Wind, and it's a Spanish book that's been translated. The author is Carlos Ruiz Zafón, and it's an international bestseller. And I think it's a bit more gothic-y, a bit more bookish. I haven't read it yet, but we'll see. So if you'd like to read along with us, that's what we're doing next month, The Shadow of the Wind.
Mary and Stephen have just discussed the book The Trouble with Goats and Sheep by Joanna Cannon. This book is available in hardcover, paperback, and downloadable audiobook. Valerie Forrester is here to read an article about a very unusual snail.
Hello, it's Valerie here, with the little snippet from the I newspaper. It's called A Postcard from Wellington, and it's by Charlotte Graham Maclay. Ned is a perfectly nice snail. If he had a dating profile, it might read, good listener, stable home, likes broccoli, seeks love. But he's exhausted his local options, and it's not because he's picky or unappealing. Instead, he's a common garden snail with an uncommon anatomical problem that's ruining his love life. Ned's shell coils to the left, not the right, making him one of the 1 in 40,000 snails whose sex organs don't line up with those of the rest of their species. Unless another lefty snail is found, the young gastropod faces a lifetime of celibacy. That dire prospect prompted a New Zealand nature lover who found the snail in her garden in August, to launch a campaign to find his perfect match. Giselle Clarkson was weeding her vegetable patch in Wairarapa on the Northern Island when a small snail tumbled out of the greens and caught her eye. I knew that I couldn't just toss the snail back into the weeds, she said. Instead, she sent a photo to her colleagues at New Zealand Geographic. The magazine launched a nationwide campaign to find a mate for Ned. But, perhaps predictably, it's been slow going. Bye for now.
It's amazing how that snail's unusual shell was spotted in the garden. Here is a poem from Jenny Horton.
This poem is called Best Before, and this is a humorous poem in the vein of Pamez. Best Before. I know I'm past my best before as I sit here on the shelf, with reduced and discount stickers, alone here, by myself. Not like young fruit, all supple and fresh. I'm not out on display. I sit here quietly, passing the time, and disguise my slow decay. My used-by dates are drawing near, as the days are passing by. Some additives and colourings save my worn-out pride. Preservatives and wrappings add appeal to my appearance, but it's only just a matter of time before I'm off to the box for clearance. So pick up this little bargain and take me home with you. You might enjoy my sweet delights as I bear my hidden fruits.
Now, the title of that poem reminds us of food, doesn't it? Well then, let's have a recipe for one of our staple dishes from Blind Baker, Penny Melville Brown, courtesy of TNF Soundings.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hello, I'm Penny Melville Brown, the Blind Baker. I won an international prize that enabled me to cook all round the world. I've written all the recipes up, I've made hundreds of videos, and I blog and write about recipes all the time. There's even a cookbook. You can find out more about me at www.pennymelvillebrown.com. Hello, everyone. Here's a very simple recipe, and I'm nearly embarrassed to tell you about it because it's so obvious, and I'm sure lots of you have done it, but I do have a little twist of my own. And this is cottage pie. So, of course, most of you know about shepherd's pie, what you make with roast lamb, the leftovers, and cottage pie is often made with leftover beef from the joint. I've even made a gobble pie with leftover turkey. But with this one, we're just going to use ordinary minced beef. So it's something you can make any time of the year, even if you haven't had a roast meal. To make this, I'm going to prepare most of it in a frying pan, but I do like to use a pan that I can pop in the oven. So it might be cast iron or something that doesn't have a plastic handle that could melt if it goes in there. I'm going to start off with two onions that are peeled and diced, and they're going to go in the pan with a couple of tablespoonfuls of olive oil. So let's sauté those onions and start getting them going transparent or soft. I can't see whether they're transparent. I just put a finger in and check the texture. Then two peeled, diced carrots, chopped up quite small because carrots take a long time to cook. I've got that all softening up now, the carrots and the onions in that frying pan. And once they're starting to soften, I'm going to scoop all of that out and pop it into a plate or a bowl on the side, and then put into the frying pan about a pound, 16 ounces, 450 grams of ordinary minced beef. I'm going to break it up as I pop it in, perhaps crumbling it through my fingers. And I just want, again, to lightly sauté it before we go much further. As it's starting to brown a little bit, I'm going to pour in half a pint of beef stock. I would often use one of those stock pots or even a cube, or perhaps you've got some nice gravy left over of something else. Pour that in, and actually now lots of people add different flavouring to give it their savouriness that is lovely in a cottage pie. Some people might use Worcestershire sauce. Can't say that very well. Worcestershire sauce. Actually, I'm going to cheat and I'm going to use two star anise. Just going to throw them into the pan with the stock. Then salt and pepper to taste. So pop in a bit now. We can always add some more later on. Now we've got that pan and we've brought it up to a very gentle bubble. And what I want to do now is lay some parchment paper over the top and then put a double layer of foil over the top. And I'm going to pop it in the oven at about gas mark 4 or 5. That's about 160, 170 degrees Celsius. And I'm going to put it in the oven now. So it got it hot on top of the cooker. I've covered it up and you could use a pan, but I want something that's pretty airtight. And that's what the parchment paper does, keeps all the liquid in. And we're going to pop it in the oven and we're just going to braise it there, probably for a couple of hours. After 10 minutes or so, we're going to turn the heat down on the oven to about gas mark 3. That's probably going to be about 150 degrees centigrade. So it's come up to temperature, got it going, turn it down and just walk away. Couple of hours later, you're going to have really nicely well-cooked beef, fragrant with that star anise. Check the seasoning, how's the salt and pepper? Add a bit more to taste. And now we just make some mashed potatoes. So simply about a pound of potatoes, peel them, boil them in water. So into cold water they start, dash of salt, bring them up to the boil, carry on boiling them until they're soft, so you can put a knife through them, and then we drain them and mash them. I have an excellent electric masher, which is fabulous. It takes no time at all. It's one of the few gadgets I do recommend. And that makes it really simple and not too messy when you can't see so well. Add some butter to your mashed potatoes, perhaps a bit of milk. For those wickedly, wickedly indulgent, there might be some cream, and again, your salt and pepper. Once you take the beef out of the oven and it's all soft and lovely, don't forget to add the onions and carrots back into it. Now, how do you want to serve this? Often I would serve it in individual ramekins, so I've got single portions. And I would be making several of these out of this mix, so I could have, say, one today, or I've got a friend or member of the family with me, I'll have a couple today, and then the rest I can freeze. So in those ramekins, put in a portion of meat, and you might fill a ramekin about half full, top it up with your mashed potato, and then those two can go into the oven, and they're just there to brown off that lovely mashed potato on top. Cover a couple of those ramekins with cling film, and once they're cool, pop them in the freezer for another day. Don't forget to label them in the best way that works for you. And there you are, a really simple lunch that is just delicious. I hope you enjoy this recipe. I hope you give it a try. If you've got ideas or suggestions for future recipes, please get in touch with me. You can always make contact through my website, www.pennymelvillebrown.com. And happy baking to all of you too. Bye-bye.
TNS Soundings.
Are you ready for the answers to the quiz questions? It's over to Fran.
Here I am again with the answers to this month's quiz questions. Did you get most of them right? Then let's see. Question 1. Which Shakespeare comedy features the characters of Oberon, Titania, Puck, and Bottom? It was B. A Midsummer Night's Dream. Question 2. What is the offspring of a male donkey and a female horse called? The answer was C, a mule. Question 3. What does DC stand for in the place name Washington, DC? It was C, District of Columbia. Question 4. What is author J.K. Rowling's first name? The answer is C, Joanne. Question 5. Where in England is the National Waterways Museum? The answer was C, Gloucester. Question 6. In ITV's Spitting Image puppet show, which former Prime Minister was depicted with grey skin and clothes? The answer was B, John Major. Question 7. In which West Country city were cricketing legend W.G. Grace and film star Cary Grant born? It was A, Bristol. Question 8. Purple Emperor, Monarch, and Queen of Spain are all types of what? The answer was B, butterflies. Question 9. Epsom Racecourse is in which English county? The answer was A, Surrey. And finally, question 10. On which Mediterranean island is the holiday resort of Magaluf? The answer was B, Mallorca. Well, I hope you enjoyed this month's challenge and got lots of the questions, or rather the answers, correct. I'll go back to my desk and see what I can find for next month's quiz. Bye for now.
Hello, I'm David, and you may remember that I've spoken on Roundabout recently about the golden age of railway travel and the London Transport buses of yesteryear. Today, I'm going to focus on the London Underground, or the Tube, as most of us Londoners call it. Actually, there is a difference between the Underground and the Tube, but I don't want to go into that just now. I've always been interested in the London subterranean transport system, the Tube, as far as I can remember. From a very early age, I became interested in the Tube map with its labyrinth of coloured lines, or the original map designed by Harry Beck, a former engineering draftsman who had lost his job with the Underground as a result of funding cuts. However, he still maintained a keen interest in London's transport system and, with time on his hands, made it a personal ambition to tidy up the higgledy-piggledy previous map by straightening out the lines, experimenting with diagonals, and evening out the distances between stations. In fact, the modern map that most of us know and love, an icon indeed, it's not really a map at all, but a diagram which doesn't in fact reflect the geography of London accurately. However, it's clear, it's colour-coded, and you can fold it up and put it in your pocket. So that's just a snapshot of the history of the map, but what about the different lines, the trains, and the stations themselves? Well, there are 11 lines. The Bakerloo, Central, Circle, District, Hammersmith and City, Jubilee, Metropolitan, Northern, Piccadilly, Victoria and Waterloo and City, each with their own colour designation. For example, the Central line is red and the District line green. It's all operated by TfL, Transport for London. There are 272 stations, and most of the system is north of the Thames, and given the total approximate length of 250 miles, it's not surprising to learn that from the sprawling London boroughs, it extends into Essex at Epping, Chorley Wood in Hertfordshire, and Amersham, Chesham, and Chalfont and Latimer in Buckinghamshire. The latter are all on the Metropolitan line. As you know, a good deal of the Tube is in tunnels with sometimes very crowded platforms and carriages. Well, they're packed like sardines, and you see those rats scurrying along the tracks. I'm sure many of us remember the barking command by the station staff. Move inside down the car, mind the gap, and mind the closing doors. I once remarked to a Piccadilly line driver that it must be dismal spending all his working day in the dark, seemingly satanic tunnels. Not at all, he replied. On my line, lots of the stations are surface ones. In fact, did you know, around 55% of the entire London Underground is not underground at all. Innovations on the Tube have been considerable over recent years. Old wooden escalators have been replaced following the King's Cross fire many years ago now. Trains have air conditioning and they're entering service rapidly. Lifts are faster and smoother. Some stations have doors which open at the exact spot that the train doors open. They're very prevalent on the Elizabethan line, or the Elizabeth line, sorry, although that is not strictly a tube line. A couple of other interesting facts. Hampstead on the Northern Line is the deepest station on the system, being 192 feet below ground level, and that's a station I once used daily. It now has high-speed lifts. The distance between stations is estimated to be 2 minutes. However, the shortest gap between stations is on the Piccadilly line between Covent Garden and Leicester Square. And you know, that's just 330 yards. As the last carriage is leaving one station, the first car is almost, but not quite, in the next. May I end on a personal note? In the 1990s, I entered a televised competition to find a new announcer to warn people of the potential danger of stepping from the platform onto the train, particularly when there was a large gap or curve between the platform and the train. Previously, the announcer said, "Mind the gap." But this time we had to say, "Please mind the gap." I came second, but I must confess it was a delight to have been judged by ex-British heavyweight boxer Henry Cooper and former Sun Page 3 girl Linda Lusardi. Well, the Northern Line, well, that's the one designated by the colour black, has always played a very important part in my life, home, work, and college. So it's perhaps highly appropriate that I've chosen a song that mentions several of my old haunts along that line: Golders Green, Camden Town, and Finchley Central. So I wonder if we could just hear now that song by the new vaudeville band, Finchley Central.
Finchley Central is 2 and 6 months from Golders Green on the Northern Line. And on the platform by the kiosk, that's where you said you'd be mine. There we made a date for hours. I waited, but I'm blowed. You never show. And Finchley Central, 10 long stations from Golders Green, change at Camden Town. I thought I'd made you, but I'm afraid you really let me down.
Thank you, David. That aptly chosen song was Finchley Central by the New Vaudeville Band. Our thanks go to John Townsend and his guest Tony Liddington, Fran Frank, David Picton, Norma Orty, Mary MacDonald, Stephen Taylor, Valerie Forrester, Jenny Horton, Penny Melville Brown, and David Quay. Thanks also to David Picton for helping me with the copy and dispatch, and to Sarah Williams for uploading the programme to our website. The programme was compiled and produced by Camilla Taylor and edited by Stephen Taylor and Mike Smith.